Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Taksim Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled The Four Clingings by Marcus Casey. In his first teaching after awakening, Shakyamuni Buddha taught that the root of suffering is clinging. In this talk, we explore four mind training statements designed to break even our most subtle clinging. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Taksim Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Hello, everyone. How's everyone doing today? Good, good. My name is Marcus Casey. I'm one of the meditation instructors here at Columbus KTC, and we're really glad to see you here today. I think the first thing let's do is to take just a moment to set our intention for being here, for listening to the talk, and our intention should be to benefit beings. So let's take one moment just to kind of internalize that. Okay, thank you. So, one of my favorite words is pith. In a tree, the pith is at the very center of the rings. And the dictionary tells us that pith is the important or essential part, the essence or core or heart. And related to the word pith, of course, is the word pithy. Pithy means brief, forceful, and meaningful in expression, full of vigor, substance, or meaning, terse, forcible. A pithy Dharma instruction is one that has been distilled to its essence. Within the body of Tibetan Buddhist literature is a genre that stands out for how pithy it is, for its inspirational power and yet concise, poignant fervor, and down-to-earth practicality, all of which have made these teachings dear to the Tibetan people for generations. And I'm talking here about a collection of texts and their associated spiritual practices known simply as Lojong, or mind training. Specifically, mind training refers to a specific approach to cultivating the awakening mind. That approach entails a disciplined process for radically transforming our thoughts and prejudices from natural self-centeredness to other-centered altruism. These are pithy slogans. They have been distilled to their very essence. Today we are going to explore some mind training verses, and these may be some you haven't heard before. This talk is a little bit different for me, so you'll have to bear with me a little bit. In preparing this talk, I became inspired by some of the words of the great teachers and the quotes, so I may be doing a little more reading today than I usually do, just because I just couldn't get beyond the way it's already written. I hope you're as inspired by this as I am. Before we go any further, it is our tradition to say the four-line refuge prayer, which is on page 4 on this little sheet. The prayer's in Tibetan. If you don't know it, listen and make the aspiration to awaken and help others to awaken. When we are chanting this, we are repeating our commitment to take refuge in the three jewels, the Buddha, or the goal, what we aspire to, the Dharma, or the path, and the Sangha, our guides and companions on the path. Let's chant this once in Tibetan, then once in English, and then the final time in Tibetan. Om Sangje Chudang Tsoki Cho Nam La Changju Bardu Dagni Gap Su Chi Dagi Jin So Ki Pe Su Nam Ki Dro La Pen Chir Sangje Tu Par Sho. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Assembly Most Excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Sangje Chudang Tsoki Cho Nam La Jang Chu Bardu Dagni Gap Su Chi Dagi Jin So Gi Pe Su Nam Gi Dro La Pin Chir Sangje Du Par Sho. Okay. So many of you are probably familiar with a set of mind training slogans that we actually use a lot around here. They are called the 7-point mind training from Chikawa Yeshe Dorje. And these are a set of 59 slogans that are grouped into 7 main points. If you aren't familiar with these, I cannot recommend enough that you pick up the book, The Great Path of Awakening. Lama Kathy teaches often from this book, so often, in fact, that she has she's had it spiral bound so that she can lay it open and teach from it more easily. You may also be familiar with the 8 verses on mind training, which His Holiness the Dalai Lama teaches a good bit, and it's another fascinating one. But what we're going to talk about today has just 4 pithy statements, and they are called the 4 clingings. These lines are said to have originated from a vision a teacher had in which Yellow Manjushri appeared to him seated on a jewel throne in the posture of a peaceful deity and amid a mass of light with a bodhisattva on each side. Yellow Manjushri then spoke the following lines. If you cling to this life, you are not a practitioner. If you cling to the 3 realms, that is not renunciation. If you cling to self-interest, you are not a bodhisattva. If grasping arises, it is not the view. The teacher then realized that all Mahayana practices converge on this training of the mind by means of letting go of the 4 clingings. Now, I fully recognize that these pithy statements of mind training are phrased in a rather confrontational way, right? You are not a practitioner. You are not a bodhisattva. But remember how these are to be used. This is not a teacher passing judgment on us from on high. This is a slogan that you repeat to yourself regularly, and then you can explore within yourself how you cling to this life and how that holds you in suffering. So don't let these confrontational statements be a source of discouragement. They are instead more of a way to course correct. If it's easier, there is another way to phrase these practices in terms more of practices. And they are, we should practice not clinging to this life, not clinging to the realms of cyclic existence, not clinging to your self-interest, not clinging to things and their symbols. So let's start with the first one. If you cling to this life, you are not a practitioner. This is the practice of not clinging to this life. And when we talk about not clinging to this life, we're talking about this lifetime, not looking beyond this lifetime that we're all in right now. Each of the four clingings comes with an antidote, and the antidote to clinging to this life is meditation on impermanence. First of all, we need to get rid of the illusion of believing that we have our whole life ahead of us. This life passes like a dream that can be interrupted at any time. This life resembles a water bubble. The time of death is uncertain, yet we know our death is inevitable. We are impermanent. So it is pointless to cling to this life. Listen to all the metaphors Shakyamuni Buddha uses to talk about our lives. And this is all in a single verse. Like a shooting star, a mirage, a flame, an optical illusion, dewdrops, bubbles in water, a dream, a lightning flash, and a cloud. Thus consider all composite things. The thought that our lives are permanent, that we can depend on waking up tomorrow, is self-deception. Guru Rinpoche said, as a river rushes to the sea, as the sun and moon glide across the mountains of the west, as days and nights, hours and moments flee, life flows away inexorably. The thought of death should always be present in a practitioner's mind, but not in a morbid or depressing way. Instead, we can use it as motivation to use every minute of life to complete the inner transformation that we as practitioners are dedicating ourselves to. We tend to tell ourselves, and I know this is really common, that as soon as we finish all our projects, we'll be able to focus better and then we can devote ourselves to the spiritual life. Maybe when my kids get older, or when I retire, or whatever that next milestone is, we tend to sometimes think, well, I'll put this off. I'll really be able to focus on it at that time. Some people think, you know, well, if only I were able to go into retreat or to do some kind of retreat, then I could practice spiritually. Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche said, just as every single thing is always moving inexorably closer to its ultimate dissolution, so also your own life, like a burning butter lamp, will soon be consumed. It would be foolish to think that you can first finish all your work and then retire to spend the later stages of your life practicing the Dharma. Can you be certain that you will live that long? Does death not strike the young as well as the old? No matter what you are doing, therefore, remember death and keep your mind focused on the Dharma. We need to become aware that every second of our life is inestimably precious, and then we must decide to make the best use of it for ourselves and others. Kampopa gives us a roadmap for our lives in practice. He said, in the beginning, you should be pursued by the fear of birth and death, like a deer escaping from a trap. In the middle, you should have nothing to regret, even if you die at this moment, like a peasant who has worked his land with care. In the end, you should be happy, like someone who has completed an immense task. The teachers say that once we come to realize our own impermanence, we move beyond the fear of death. The great philosopher Nagarjuna said, "With all its many risks, this life endures no more than windblown bubbles in a stream. How marvelous to breathe in and out again, to fall asleep and then awake refreshed." There is a story that is told to us about Patru Rinpoche, and it's one of my favorite stories ever in Buddhist literature. One day, Patru Rinpoche, and Patru Rinpoche, if you don't know, he was a famous wandering monk in the 1800s, and there are many, many stories told about Patru Rinpoche. And one day, he was accompanied by his friend Pema Dorje, and they decided to go to a monastery that they were near. He slowly walked along the shore of the Black Lake, reached the glaciers of the rampart of Thromgo, and then a sacred mountain, one of whose sides is a sheer cliff known as the Queen of the Fierce Rock. On its lonely but blessed slopes lived a great meditator who had spent most of his life in retreat. He had not studied much, but he had reached the final stage of the contemplative path of the great perfection. For warm clothing, he wore only a worn-out sheepskin over a simple tunic with the collar and hem sewed inside out. He had never traveled, having remained day and night sitting on his mat, absorbed in deep meditation. Upon arrival, Patru Rinpoche prostrated 3 times before the hermit and asked him to deliver the teachings of the essence of luminous space according to the spiritual lineage of the patriarchs of that monastery. So the first day, this meditator folded his hands on his heart and recited a few verses of the teaching, and then repeated the first verse slowly 3 times. And it goes like this: "Alas, it is difficult to bring together the freedoms and favorable conditions conducive to the realization of enlightenment." Tears rolled down his cheeks. Patru Rinpoche also began to cry, and the meditator remained silent for a moment. That was the day's teaching. The next day, the meditator taught in the same way, without recourse to texts, but drawing directly on his personal experience. Here are the words he uttered: "The life of beings rushes by like a mountain waterfall." He folded his hands again, and weeping continued after a pause. "Do not waste the favorable conditions and freedoms that you have been granted. Do not let your life be spent in vain." At that point, Patru Rinpoche's friend Pema Dorje said to himself, "How amazing. Look at Patru Rinpoche, a master who knows all the teachings perfectly, receiving instructions as basic as that. Yet at the mere mention of the rarity of a human existence, master and disciple both began to cry." And I love that story for how it shows that with all the many teachings and the advanced teachings and practices and things like there are like that in Buddhism, the basics are still so very important. And one of the basics is to always keep in mind that you have this precious life. It is fleeting. And what you have found in this life in finding the Dharma teachings and being able to use those Dharma teachings to escape the cycle of suffering for yourself and others is a rare and precious gift, and we should use those use this time wisely. So the first clinging is to keep that in mind and recognize that this life should not be clinged to, but that we should recognize how precious it is and use it, knowing that it will end at any moment. A second clinging. If you cling to the three realms, that is not renunciation. So technically, the three realms are the desire realm, the form realm, and the formless realm. But for our purposes, we can understand it basically as just to say samsara, the cycle of birth and rebirth. If you cling to samsara, that is not renunciation. We are talking about not clinging to all the things in this life, all the things that that actually cause us suffering. The antidote to clinging to samsara is to reflect on the defects of cyclic existence. This entire existence in samsara, it is said, is like poisonous fruit. Although it may be tasty in the moment, ultimately it destroys. He who clings to it is fooling themselves. What we call happiness is generally a source of suffering. We long for the eight mundane concerns, thinking that these will bring us happiness. We reach for pleasure, but then we find it is impermanent. When the pleasure passes, as it always does, we're left clinging to it. We avoid pain, but pain is inevitable. We fight against it and suffer because we consider it unfair. We strive for gain, sacrificing all our time and energy, and find that it is never enough. It does not make us happy, and it does not last. We fear loss and spend our lives dreading any downturn of fortune, struggling through toxic work environments to cling to what we have. We seek praise even from those whom we do not respect and lose sight of what matters most to us in an effort to win approval. Yet we are always one wrong word away from blame. No one wants to be the focus of blame, so it gets passed like a hot potato until it lands in someone's lap. We cultivate a good reputation, hoping we can find happiness in fame, but we find reputations are also impermanent and a poor refuge. As much as we avoid a bad reputation, we cannot always influence others' perceptions, and we can sink into despair if we are ridiculed. And all of this can happen on social media in just a single day, right? So when we cling to samsara, we're placing our happiness in that which will not last, inevitably letting us down. The great teacher Asanga says that there are several reasons why pleasures never fully satisfy. First, he says, those pleasures do not satisfy both the body and the mind. Two, they depend on external circumstances over which we never have complete control. Three, they are not always immediately available whenever and wherever we would want them. Four, pleasures don't fully satisfy because they are no help in developing the qualities such as faith, discipline, generosity, and so forth. Fifth, we cannot take what produces those pleasures with us at the time of death and in future lives. Sixth, pleasures are not in themselves an ultimate goal. Seven, the process of enjoyment is such that it necessarily disappears sooner or later, like a match consumed by its flame, and the slightest adverse circumstance may bring it to an end. And eight, the benefit produced by those pleasures, far from providing a complete satisfaction, creates ever more intense desire. I mean, why do you think people can never get enough? Look at, you know, the rich are always trying to get richer. All of us are always trying to get richer. It can never be enough. In fact, Asanga says, on reflection, pleasures are the cause of great frustration and repeated suffering. They can only increase our torments, just as scratching a wound momentarily seems to relieve the itch, when in reality it aggravates the wound and leads to worse discomfort in the future. But the happiness that is provided by the Dharma is quite different. It permeates the body and mind at all times and in all circumstances. The more we taste it, the deeper is our satisfaction. No enemy and no event can take it from us, and its benefits continue into our future lives. That is why it is an ultimate goal to achieve. The path of Dharma dispels all suffering. It leads to true happiness and the total disappearance of all disturbing emotions and harmful behavior. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the word renunciation, because that's mentioned in this one. If you cling to the three realms, that is not renunciation. So we are called to practice renunciation. And I think when we hear that word, we tend to tense up a little bit. We work hard in our lives to provide for ourselves and our families, and the idea of giving up whatever security we have been able to create is frankly quite scary. But true renunciation is not a constraint, but a freedom. It comes from the strong desire to end the frustration inevitably created by the ordinary preoccupations of life. Someone who renounces the world to escape from the prison of illusion is like a bird escaping from its cage to fly in the sky. It does not matter whether the cage is made of gold or base metal, it is still a prison. If you approach renunciation out of a sense of guilt or as a feeling that you have some kind of duty to fulfill, or because you walk away from this talk with the idea that in order to be a good Buddhist, you have to give away all your possessions, and that's not what I'm saying, by the way. If you do it from that attitude, you are going to be renouncing things as a constraint, and it will end in frustration and regret. Renunciation essentially means simplifying one's mind, one's words, and one's activities by letting go of what obstructs inner freedom. Constraint creates frustration. Renunciation produces a real sense of joy. When we practice renunciation, we are not necessarily getting rid of things. We are getting rid of our attachments. Renunciation does not mean depriving yourself of what is truly good and useful in life, but rather of getting rid of unnecessary burdens. It unclutters life to allow us to focus completely on what is truly enriching. When we drop our attachments, we may find that many of our possessions are not serving us. We are serving them. And instead, they've become an obstacle to a simple and meaningful life. There are things in all of our lives that we have become attached to, but that do not lead us toward any kind of joy. Some of these things, like social media, for example, steal even our temporary happiness, although it's difficult to break our attachments to them. Some of these things fool us into thinking they are making us happy because there is a transient enjoyment that comes from them. But in truth, our attachment to them distracts us from that which will free us and others from our suffering. I actually read a book recently that was very fascinating, and it was talking about how social media companies may not have started out to do this, but it's basically has become a chemistry experiment on the chemicals of our brain, right? Social media is designed to keep those little shots of dopamine coming so that we keep going back for more and more and more. And they're not designing it in a way that would make us happy or full of joy. but rather in a way that would engage us more. And a couple of the examples were, why doesn't Facebook have a feature where you can see if there are friends, Facebook friends in your area? Why doesn't it suggest, hey, you guys are close by, do you guys want to meet? Because if you meet, it takes your eyeballs off the screen, right? They're not about you and your friends. They're about your engagement, your attention, and you seeing the ads that they have to show. Another example of that is that they found that words that rile us up are more likely to keep us scrolling. And so, obviously, those are not words that bring us joy, but they're words that keep us there. And so that's what I mean, that sometimes these things are not actually bringing us happiness in the moment, and yet they're so hard to give up. And they keep us addicted. And we know they aren't bringing us lasting joy. So my challenge for you this week is to see if you can identify just even a single attachment that's an obstruction to your joy, that's an obstruction to your happiness, that maybe you started out as a way to bring happiness into your life. Maybe it's a possession, maybe it's something that is really holding you back from that simple, meaningful life. The third clinging says, if you cling to self-interest, you are not a bodhisattva. So this is the practice of not clinging to self-interest. If you cling to your own self-interest, you may gain something temporarily, but in the long run, you are sowing the seeds of your ruin. Have you ever looked at the world and felt like the good people in it are always losing? Do you look at the rich and powerful and see how selfish so many of them are? There's no denying that acting purely out of self-interest can bring short-term results sometimes. But it will never bring happiness, never joy, and the gain it brings will never last. We might sometimes catch ourselves envying people whom we think have it all. Certainly they don't have the problems that we struggle with. We know this life is flawed and we see it in our own lives, but look in so-and-so. They live such a charmed existence. But this is not correct. They too are within the bounds of suffering. Although they have far more resources than we do, they too will die. And our teachers say that they may have used up a lot of karma that led to such a charmed existence, so they may have a much less advantageous rebirth. And so the wheel of existence turns. Shantideva said, all the joy the world contains has come through wishing happiness for others. All the misery the world contains has come from wanting pleasure for oneself. Is there need for lengthy explanation? Childish beings look out for themselves while Buddhas labor for the good of others. See the difference that divides them? By bringing joy to beings, I please the Buddhas also. By wounding them, I wound the Buddhas too. I mentioned another Lojong teaching called the 8 Verses on Mind Training, that it's a favorite of Holiness the Dalai Lama, and I am going to read you 2 of these verses because they talk a whole lot about that self-clinging versus altruism. They're very challenging. The first one says, whenever I interact with others, I will view myself as inferior to all, and I will train myself to hold others superior from the depths of my heart. Have you ever watched the Dalai Lama meet somebody for the first time? Have you ever seen how palpable it is that he is 100% focused on that person in front of him that he's meeting? How how he just looks like he's interested in who they are. And this is a man who is in a high station in life. He's won a Nobel Peace Prize, things like that. And yet he is so engaged with each person that he meets. And I think it's probably from internalizing verses like this. I will train myself to hold others superior from the depths of my heart. And again, we need to be careful with some of these things. These are practices that you work on because we have a natural tendency to look down on people. We have a natural tendency to cling to ourselves, and the point of it is to sever that. It's not to hurt our self-esteem or something like that. The point is to sever that clinging we have to ourselves. The second verse is, when others, out of jealousy, treat me wrongly with abuse and slander, I will train to take the defeat upon myself and offer the victory to others. We live in a very competitive society. And we live in a society where that competitiveness is encouraged, right? I mean, that's our economic system is built on that. A lot of our entertainment, like, everything from sports to game shows, things like that, is built on that competitiveness and that push to win. And we raise our children with a desire to make the best out of themselves and to achieve. And so this is such a reversal of that. I will train to take the defeat upon myself and offer the victory to others. So the antidote to self-clinging is bodhicitta, the awakening mind. You can reflect that it is useless if I alone gain freedom from my suffering and all others remain in samsara. And one practice that we have to think about that and to arouse that compassion towards all others is to remember that the teachings say that our previous lives have gone on since beginningless time, and there was never a beginning. And in that time, each one of those beings have been our mother or our parent or our child. We have had a close connection with each one of those beings, no matter what our relationship is with them in this life. And so practices like that, and there are many, many practices we use to arouse bodhicitta and to arouse that compassion for other beings. Practices such as this are a means to break our self-clinging and embrace all others. Just as contemplating the preciousness of a human life brought Patril Rinpoche in that story, how it brought him to tears, so we must train in recognizing the suffering of all beings that we may never cease to be moved by the misery of others. Those who have taken the bodhisattva vow and become, as Lama Kathy likes to say, bodhisattvas in training, have made a conscious choice to work to alleviate the suffering of others in this lifetime and beyond. This must be our guiding principle, and we can only do it to the extent that we learn to overcome self-clinging. And now we come to the fourth clinging. If grasping arises, it is not the view, or not clinging to things and their symbols. So this one's a little bit more advanced. Actually, there's kind of an advancement in all of these. This is a graduated process. The previous one focused on our attachment to self, and the antidote to that is the development of compassion or relative bodhicitta. This slogan is about that which prevents us from developing wisdom or absolute bodhicitta. Now we are talking about clinging to self-existence, the mistaken notion that the self, and in fact all phenomena, have the nature of existence. It is a failure to realize that all things have the nature of emptiness, which is better understood as limitlessness. In the 15th century, a commentary was written on these verses by someone named Kunga Lekpai Rinchen, and he wrote, "Clinging to things and their symbols is like grasping at a mirage that appears to be water. It may look like water right now, but you cannot drink it. Although this cyclic existence appears to your deluded mind, if you analyze it with wisdom, you find nothing that exists by means of its own nature. Therefore, cultivate the understanding that does not dwell on the past. Become immersed in the present or project into the future. And in this way, recognize all things as free of conceptual elaborations." So even if relative bodhicitta, if our compassionate mind has arisen well, if you still grasp at existence, you will fall into the abyss of either absolutism or nihilism. And that is not the middle way. And you will be unable to gain freedom. As an antidote to grasping at things and their symbols, you need to cultivate tranquil abiding and penetrative insight. So those are key words. Those are practices we have. What are tranquil abiding and penetrative insight? They are shamatha and vipassana. Shamatha being the kind of meditation that we teach in our intro to meditation practice, in which you calm the mind and develop focus. And then we teach a variety of vipassana or insight meditation practices. And we teach the insurpassable Mahamudra teachings that is the union of shamatha and vipassana. And I won't go much further into this topic. It's a difficult topic and one that, frankly, I'm not qualified to expound upon apart from repeating the words of our lineage teachers. So by conducting yourself in this manner, not clinging to this life, you will avoid the birth in lower realms. If you cease clinging to this life and direct your mind to Dharma practice, you truly become a practitioner who is well on their way toward the goal of becoming a Buddha. By not clinging to the three realms of cyclic existence, samsara, you avoid rebirth in samsara. If you cease clinging to cyclic existence, you ensure success in your Dharma practice. By not clinging to self-interest, you avoid rebirth as a disciple or a self-realized one, which is to say, those who have spiritual attainment, but who have not severed their clinging to self-interest and awakened bodhicitta, they cannot reach Buddhahood like that. Cease clinging to self-interest and dedicate yourself to alleviating the suffering of others. And by not clinging to things and their symbols, you quickly attain perfect enlightenment. Cease clinging to conceptual mind completely and eliminate your delusions. These show how increasingly cutting our clinging leads to a higher state of spiritual perfection. Examine your clinging this week. Look for areas you have not let go, and then experience the joy of release, of renunciation, as you move deeper to develop your bodhicitta. I hope this has helped someone. We have time, plenty of time, for questions or comments. And we have a question microphone over here if you'd like to come up and ask a question. Yes, Michael, thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the difference between grasping and clinging and attachment and sort of appreciation. Because when you're sort of thinking about the defects of samsara, you understand that in some sense, but then I think, what about when I'm standing in front of a waterfall? What about when I'm standing on a mountaintop, when I'm appreciating the glorious beauty of nature? Mm-hmm. That seems pretty great. And I think there's probably a skillful way to deal, or, you know, holding your newborn for the first, you know, like there's mm-hmm. a skillful way to think about those things mm-hmm. while keeping all those other four clingings in mind. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yes, very much so. So I'll tell you what Lama Cathy has said about something like this. One thing she said that has always stuck with me is that when we are moved by beauty or great art, that internal emotion that rises being moved is an indication of our Buddha nature. It's not something you should try to move beyond. It's actually the sun shining through the clouds a little bit. So number one, you know, I don't think you should take moments like that to try to say, no, push that down and say, this brings me clinging to samsara or to this life. But instead to recognize that beauty as how it makes you feel as your Buddha nature. And another practice she often does is to take that beauty and dedicate it as an offering, like the offerings on our shrine. And like, you know, we gather things of beauty and things that are useful to us, money and fruit and food and all these things, pleasant smells and flowers and incense. We gather these things and we offer those to the Buddhas. And you can do that mentally with everything, standing in front of a waterfall. You can offer that to the Buddhas. And then you can offer that pleasant experience as to all beings, that all beings may experience that kind of beauty and that kind of peace that you're experiencing now. So no, I don't think we should ever take the pleasurable things that we have and try to convince ourselves of why they are not good in some way. Again, the renunciation is to the attachment to that. If you walk away from that waterfall and you find yourself unhappy in daily life because you're not back at that waterfall, that's where I think you've got some kind of attachment. You're not able to be present where you are. But I definitely think there is a lot of beauty in the world. And we find that beauty, you know, amongst our friends and family and in nature and things like that. And we don't deny that. We practice a middle way, which is to say that we don't practice. The Buddha himself did not find that when he practiced all these austerities and starved himself nearly to the point of death, he did not reach enlightenment doing that. And so we don't practice a path that requires us to avoid anything like that, the beauty that would inspire. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. I was kind of struck by what you said about the emptiness. Mm-hmm. And you had mentioned nihilism earlier, you know, sort of the belief mm-hmm. that sort of nothing has any meaning or nothing really matters. Mm-hmm. And I kind of liked what you said, I think what you said about emptiness, being able to take a look at it as limitlessness, mm-hmm. as opposed to sort of emptiness and something that has no inherent meaning. Could you, mm-hmm. you know, I find myself kind of falling into this trap sometimes where I, you know, where I'm letting go of things and I'm trying to, you know, trying to let go of things, and it seems like there's nothing to hold on to, and I just start getting lost, and I feel like I'm falling into nihilism. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you?
Yeah, I'll try.
Okay, I'm sorry.
This is really complicated. So, and it's a very, very good question. I think, and I think it is one that's easy to fall into. I think some of it is our translation that we ended up with emptiness, and to us, emptiness implies a void, right? And that's where it seems more nihilistic. But the emptiness that we're talking about is the emptiness of self-existence, or sometimes they say empty of existing from their own side. And what that means is that the existence we see all around us is it's a whole concert of interconnectedness, right? I only exist right now. My life is only here because that ceiling is staying up and not falling on my head. And that came from, you know, the trees that created the frame of the ceiling, and the workers who, you know, made their lives, and they go back generations and generations. There's just, we don't have some kind of existence apart from that. We don't have this solid, unchanging permanence that we think we do. And if we recognize that, then we can reduce our clinging to everything that's around us because we recognize how impermanent it is. It's almost like if forms or if ourself are not empty, that means we have definable attributes. We have eternal attributes that define us. But if we are empty of all those concepts ultimately, then we are limitless, right? There is no defining who we are. And that's the best way I can come up with, although I know Lama Kathy really prefers that word limitless. You'll run into the word emptiness in a lot of texts, and that's how they're translated. But it's not a nothingness, and it's not a void. I know when people talk about relative bodhicitta and absolute bodhicitta, sometimes the question comes up, well, you know, if the absolute bodhicitta says that nothing actually exists, then the suffering that people are experiencing doesn't exist either, right? And that's the nihilism trap, right? Because the fact is that no matter what the existence is, we are experiencing that suffering. We are trapped in this cycle. We have not realized it, and even for those who go on to be great bodhisattvas and realize emptiness completely, it just develops more their compassion for those of us who have not. And that's the way it should be. It's not a thing to kind of write off or explain away the suffering of beings as not being important at all. As a matter of fact, those who reach that level of understanding and that perfection of wisdom just increase in their ability to feel compassion. So I don't know if that helps or not. But.
Well, the when you said interconnectedness, you know, I think that also helped me, you know, just being connected to everything else also sort
right.
of helps reinforce
right.
that idea. But the, yeah, very much right. so. Thank you.
That and was, we don't exist apart from that interconnectedness in any way. Mm-hmm. There's not some solid existence apart from that whole web. So.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We've got time for another one.
Hi.
Hello.
I was curious because you were talking about, I mean, this whole talk has been about, I believe, learning how to let go and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give sort of a simple practice? Maybe it is meditation. Maybe I'm just, this is sort of a redundant question, mm-hmm. but could you give some sort of a practice in order to, if you're able to mm-hmm. Sort of get the feeling for it? Mm-hmm. That way you can bring it into other aspects of your life.
Sure, sure. So the first, I would say the first two are actually very well covered by a contemplation on what's called the four thoughts that turn the mind toward Dharma. And that is a really common practice. When you start to do some of the practices that daily practices, sometimes those are how you start. And they basically go through a contemplation, a short contemplation, four little contemplations that you do about about death, how death is inevitable, that we are all impermanent. And then about the preciousness of life and how rare it is to attain a precious life. And about the workings of karma and how all of our actions lead to necessarily to certain results, and we'll have results according to our actions. And then also to the unsatisfactory nature of samsara. And those four contemplations are really meant to get us to the point where we realize the importance of Dharma practice and how much more critical it is than all of the more mundane things that we do in life. It is, it's a simple practice. It's just basically read a statement and then you contemplate it. And I'm sure if you looked for four thoughts that turn the mind to Dharma or something like that online, you can probably find those four thoughts. But yeah, that's a practice that we do. We do it daily, and it's to internalize the concepts that we're talking about here, to internalize our own impermanence, to internalize the fact that samsara is not going to bring us happiness, and therefore to allow us to really develop within ourselves the fundamental understanding that there is something that will bring us happiness, that will bring us joy, and that does matter. And so that's why they're called the four thoughts that turn our minds to Dharma, because they're the thoughts that take us away from that clinging that's so natural to this life and turn our minds toward practice. So.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you all for listening and for the really good questions. So if you all want to pick up your sheets again, we always end by dedicating the merit of this talk. Anytime we attend teachings or practices like this and support KTC in any way, that actually brings, it develops our own virtuousness, right? It develops virtue. And we don't want to just hold the benefits of that to ourselves. We want to dedicate that all beings can be free from suffering. So let's go ahead and read in English, page 31 on the sheet. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. The courageous Manjushri, who knows everything as it is, Samantabhadra, who also knows in the same way, and all the bodhisattvas, that I may follow in their path, I completely dedicate all this virtue. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.